Part 3. Tell the women I'm lonely. Kuliana. The past is never where you think you left it. Catherine Ann Porter, Ship of Fools. Winter 2016, Peterborough, New Hampshire. What we do is burn things. A Chinese New Year family tradition since before I was born. We write lists of burdens, toxins, enemies, vices. We place the strips of paper in a bowl, and we burn them. We watch our words shrivel and dissolve like a slug under salt. We burn things for luck. We burn things to move on. We burn things just to watch them burn. I am writing my list today. It is the year of the monkey. When I get the call from my mother, it's snowing. The whole world is the thin color of skim milk. Hello? A siren whines out behind her voice, a scream. The house, she says, it's gone. What house? What do you mean? I lit the candle, says my mother, the one by his urn, for the new year. The flame caught the drapes, she says, or the match caught the basket, I don't know. I'm standing in the center of a parking lot. I am wearing red, for luck. It's the new year after all. I force myself to remember the facts. I am standing in a parking lot in New Hampshire. I am alive. My mother is alive. My father is dead. My mother is in Florida. She's right here, on the phone. Something has happened. What's happened? I say. Grandma Maymay and I are fine, she says. Just burn some hair. It's just hair. That's good, I say. But the house, she says, it's gone. I need you to understand that. Later that day, I begin a mental catalog of everything in that house. Boxes of photographs, yellowed horse ribbons, diaries, magic kits, dried up nail polishes, my homecoming crown, my stuffed tiger, Tia, my mother's wedding dress, my father's leather loafers, his couch, my father's couch, his sports jackets, his back scratchers, his Yankees cap, that couch, my father, my mother's Hawaiian blanket, her crystal bonsai trees, her childhood jeans, the spot on the floor. The spot will be gone. This brings me some relief. I will never have to see the spot again. I tell my mother to get on a plane. Come meet me here, I say. No fires here. Okay, she says. I have nowhere else to go. That night, I prop wood in a pyramid in my fireplace. I stuff papers underneath, old manuscripts, receipts, napkins, before grinding the match. I watch the flames flick purple, then gold. Home, I write on my Chinese New Year list. I circle it 3 times, wad it up and toss it. Spring, 1971. Kailua, Oahu, Hawaii. I'm not here. My mother, Lokelani, is the oldest of 4 children. She's a good girl, 11 years old, punahele of the family, hiapo, the tiniest frame. Her sister Tao, my auntie T, is 1 year younger than my mother, a stocky little thing, and the two sisters don't like each other much. Not yet. My mother is the favorite, bright in the eyes, she works hard in school, and little Tao steals her jeans to hem them several inches so that they hit my mother above the ankle. She's jealous of her older sister. The two of them tend to 2 younger brothers, Makoa and Kai, but brothers are not a part of this story. Not yet, anyway. First, I want to tell you a story about sisters. The children live on Puolo Street in Kailua, Oahu. They wear bathing suits beneath their clothes to school, Enchanted Lakes Elementary. No shoes, never. They learn to hula with the proper bend at the knees. They roast pigs with their tutu and toss hunks of meat into the mouths of volcanoes, an offering to Pele, the fire goddess. The only house on the block with a pool and a slide, a boat out back, the children swing on banyan vines and play Gilligan's Island in the red fizz of late afternoons, throwing the rocks from their yard at the neighbor's fence. They perform their own Hawaiian Partridge Family songs at night. Scraped knees, matching floral prints, they harmonize. Their parents applaud them, proud, beautiful, this family act, the American dream. Sure, there are fights. Whose idea was it to wax their father's boat? Whose idea was it to push so hard, to use the wrong kind of wax, that white putty that clouded the boat a permanent pink? A Pepto-Bismol pink, my mother thinks. She is obsessed with the thought. It was Tao's fault. And so she feeds the chalky tablets to her younger sister. It's candy, good for you. Until the whole bottle is empty, until Tao's stomach must be pumped. When the children scream at one another, they are hung in burlap potato sacks from the mango trees in the yard. Their skin matches the color of the sacks, and the snaggly fabric tears at their armpits. Their whole bodies itch. The siblings swing there until the sun comes up, until they make good on what they've done. Or, let's move to the father, my grandfather, Al, who bought what he has named the frustration release paddle, a sleek leather body to it, a rope on the end. The children line up outside the bathroom door, oldest to youngest, waiting for their turn. Al sits on the toilet seat, pulls each of them over his lap, thwacking them until they understand. My mother apologizes right away. She is the punahele, after all. She is always let go. But her sister will not cry, will not budge, will not be sorry, not ever. I don't even feel it. And so the boys rarely ever get their turn. In one of my earliest memories of my grandfather, he is about to drive me and my cousins, Tao's children, Tegan and Tanya, to dinner in Plantation, Florida. We're in matching sunflower dresses. It's the weekend of his birthday. I like it when we match like this, because people are less likely to point me out as a child who does not fit with these two beautiful girls, the cousin, not a sister. My grandfather slams the car door once we're all buckled in, but Tanya's hand is not inside the car yet, not all the way, and her finger crunches in the aluminum jaw of it. She screams out, "Please, help!" Her face a raisin, tears and spit, and a pitch so high it vibrates the air inside. But my grandfather does not move. There is no release. His face is stern outside the car window, his silver ponytail shining. "Embrace your pain," he says, "and stop crying." Tegan and I hold her other hand. By now we are almost crying too. "Calm down," we say, or think. I can't be sure now. "Keep it together." Tanya tugs in her lip, gasps for deeper breaths. She steadies her face somehow, she does, before my grandfather opens the door. But Tanya's mother, Tao, doesn't give her father what he wants. She is different here in the bathroom in 1971, just a child. I don't even feel it, the paddle coming down harder. My mother waits outside the door, listening. The burn beneath her own pants, the warmer spots. She touches the places where she will bruise. She's on a plane in her mind, my mother, a flight attendant, getting off this rock in the ocean, so far from this bathroom, the line of light beneath this door, Tao's voice screaming, "I still don't feel it!" Fall, 2015. Atlantic Beach, New York. Before my father's funeral, in my parents' bedroom on the beach, I ask my mother about that old mannequin, Uncle Nuke. I am blow-drying a pair of blue suede shoes to help the leather stretch, to fit my feet into them, when I ask her how she ever got rid of him. Where? She can't remember. Not now. "I wish I could talk to him again," I tell my mother. We pull our funeral dresses over our heads, white and silk. She places a purple lei of orchids over my shoulders, kisses me on each cheek, and I do the same for her. I think we look too young for this. "Should we order some pizza for after the service?" she asks. "How many people are staying over?" "Did you take him to a dump?" I want to know. "Are your brothers staying over?" she asks. I wish I could know what Uncle Nuke remembers. "Why?" she says. "Is today really the day for this?" If I were giving the eulogy, I would say, "My family began with a mannequin." "You should speak today," she says, nodding. "That mannequin was the beginning." "He wasn't supposed to die, Mom." "He wasn't supposed to die in a hospital," she says. "That's true." "You shouldn't have thrown him away." "That's a different story." Maybe the unfinished story is the story. We hold the funeral at the Sands Club in the town of Lawrence, Long Island, where my father had a senior prom. Just last month, he told me about this place, the music, Be My Little Baby, the arm wrestling and bottle fights in the parking lot. I'll know it when I'm going to die. I'm buzzed on the cinnamon whiskey my brothers and I shared behind the stage curtain. My thumbnail is pressing moons into my late orchids as people speak. I take inventory of who shows up, my father's doormen and chauffeurs, ex-business partners, Clarissa, and I hear, gambling man, madman, father, always to jokes, even money, from the microphone. I sit on my hands. I chew on my hair. Dad, you would have liked this crowd. Everyone's dressed sharp for you. I count chandeliers. I think about sea monkeys and those mannequin legs in the corner of our first apartment and Di Vernon shuffling cards, the weather. Cheated on a math test, his first wife, because that's how it was in the army. Ha, 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 ha. How he did it. Bet on life. Thought invincible. I think about the carpet of this place, and my shoes are too fucking tight, and that little red wagon I had as a kid, how he'd helped me paint it blue, and we glued it all over with cotton balls until it was a time machine. And lobsters, the way he used to bring them home on Sundays, that was before I really knew my dad, when he was just a man who carried thrashing paper bags on his shoulders, when he was just a man who said, I caught us some lobsters, and I smashed them, and I ate them. Photographs are projected to the song Free Bird. A tissue box is passed down our row. I don't know when the slideshow started, but it's ending. Dad, you loved this part of the song. You pumped the gas and brake pedals of your convertible in time with this guitar solo until my seatbelt locked and dug into my shoulder and the whole thing made me sick. The sun is in your eyes. There we are. We release my father's ashes the next day. Winter, 1972. Kailua, Oahu, Hawaii. See the encyclopedia over my grandfather's knee in the study of their house, his finger finding the golden notch of the letter F. My mother, Tao, and the boys sitting in a semicircle at my grandfather's feet. Florida, he says. He stretches the syllables as if it's a healing word. Florida. It's on the mainland. It looks like a sock, or a gun, maybe. He points to the state on a map. In Florida, people plug straws right into oranges, and everyone has blonde hair, an alligator sunbathe, and kids wear shoes to school. Shoes to school. My mother cannot believe this. She will remember it as long as she lives. Shoes to school? What would it be like on the mainland, away from Tutu, away from Paulele Street, Hanama Bay, the sweet thick pull of hapia between her teeth. Yes, she has always been curious about a life somewhere else, but what gods or friends would she have in this Florida? Why are we leaving? Tao wants to know, but there is no answer. Yeah, why? Asks my mother. She has a better chance. We leave next week, says my grandfather, so you'll need to pack your things and start cleaning. My grandma Maymay stands in the corner of the room. She considers this conversation, this rush. Her husband, her first love, Ulua, who had picked her up from the soda stand at the beach. She worked there, watched old mokes move chess pieces in the trade winds. One day, Al showed up. A native Hawaiian man through and through. He was gentle, akamai, older, a talker. Always in a sailor's cap, he was worldly, and so she said yes, and so she agreed, and so she married him 3 days after her 16th birthday. They exchanged vows at the Mormon church, where they would soon work. He is a priest, and she a Sunday school teacher. Yes, she loved this man. In this part of the story, she still does. But here's the first moment Maymay questions her husband, his body leaning forward in the living room chair. This encyclopedia open on his lap. Florida. The diamond ring. She knows. Al sold jewels to Hawaiian retailers out of the trunk of his Lincoln. Pink coral carefully arranged in velvet boxes. So expensive kind. All of it shipped from the mainland. He had mentioned the ring when it went missing from his collection last month, in emphasis on his words, missing. The diamond ring has gone missing. She had noticed other leftover stock that came home with him lately. Worthless, not for sale, out of their cases. But the diamond ring? She'd remembered that most, the value of it. He was too careful with his words. His wife had to know the exact time and day it happened. His pockets and drawers flipped, emptied. The diamond ring has gone missing, he'd repeated. That red boat appeared 2 days later. Yes, she knows why it's time to go. Winter 2015, Voorheesville, New York. Here's what happens after death. Every object changes shape. All the little objects of hope, innocuous, gentle things, the bottles of Diet Coke saved for when he would get better, the stacks of New York Posts, the wedges of pineapple, the warmer socks, the protein powders, the Chinese herbs, the electroacupuncture pens, the pictures, all the pictures, removed and naked of their frames, brighter in the corners, the pictures, gum-tacked to the hospital bed, for when he would remember, he would, these objects, every last one of them, become the most unbearable of all, the most acutely garish, the splintered underside of the table on which you have tried to smoothly splay out the map of your new life without this person, whom you just so happen to love most. I'm spending the holidays with Hannah and her family before I leave for New Hampshire. Someone else's family, I repeat, because your father is dead. This year, there will be no Hanukkah candles, no botched Hebrew prayers, no wads of cash, no marathon of Michael Corleone. Your father, dead. Hannah is gentle with me, and sometimes I wish you were not so gentle. That's the way other people have been treating me, the way they look at me as they quietly stir their coffee spoons, the way they creep around the facts. Hannah changes my clothes when I've been crying too hard to keep my balance. She pins my arms down when I have night terrors of tubes and machines, reminds me of where I am. When we have sex, I ask her to choke me. I want to hurt. I want flashes behind my eyes. We go on like this for weeks. On Christmas Eve day, Hannah tacks up the mares in her yard and wraps my calves with horse polos. She weaves her hands together for my knee, lifting me into the saddle. Up, up, let's move, she says. Hannah, who brought me back to horses. Hannah, who kissed me for an hour straight the first time it happened, in a dark bar full of drag queens and popcorn, her palms cradling my face, the way she called me Thunder Snow. We ride through the mountains of her hometown, she and I. We spend the day like this, the yellow, protracted light of frozen noon, cattails swaying. It's been 52 days, and this is the first time I feel like I might live. The next morning, she kneels beside her family's tree, handing over boxes of gifts, beautiful gifts, books and scarves and blenders and stockings full of gifts. Pity gifts, I think. She keeps her arms wrapped around me as I open each one, kissing the temple of my head. It makes me sad, the degree of love I feel for her, the life-saving power of this purity of purpose, now that I know what it feels like to lose. Hannah's mother hands me a box no bigger than a diary. I peel open the paper. A bright green DNA test. You mentioned you wanted one, she says. Remember, at the funeral. For the family tree, yes, I say. I try to smile. Thanks. I stack the gifts in my arms and totter up the stairs to Hannah's bedroom. I clack the blinds closed. I am 12 years old on Christmas morning in Las Vegas. My father takes me, my mother, and the boys to Denny's, where he asks for his eggs runny, extra rye. He slides a $100 bill tip to our waitress, something he will make a tradition. And the woman thanks us, wipes her cheeks, holds the bill up to the light of the window to make sure it's real. Here is a Hawaiian legend once told to me. Sometimes the dead don't want to be dead. Sometimes Souls go flitting around in the air, particles of light drifting until a mortal crams the soul back inside its body. The Kino Wailua, or spirits, can be spotted anywhere, the face of a rock, a mountainside. A Hawaiian should always look for facial features. It is the mortal's job to perform the kapuku, or resuscitation process. It is our duty to sneak the soul beneath the toenail of a body, let the body rise up like a newly watered plant. Winter through Spring, 1972. United States of America. In Los Angeles, Maymay and Al use the cash from a second mortgage to purchase a motorhome. The family will drive for the rest of the school year, 5 months on the road, visiting every state capital, billboard attraction, the petrified forest, the children's first snow. My mother and her siblings are homeschooled by Maymay. They visit the Grand Canyon, the gaping marble monuments of Washington, D.C., Badlands of Red, and Maymay uses the encyclopedias to tell them all about it. State bird, state fruit, state capital, state terrain, you must learn about your world. There is no plan, no exact destination, as long as they stay on the move. "Where are you headed?" a man at a gas station in Memphis asks one night. "Moving house like that? All those kids?" "Florida," says my grandfather. "Nice and sunny. Whereabouts?" asks the man. My grandfather looks at Maymay as if she might have the answer, as if she'd have the perfect city in mind, a star pinned to the map. He had never thought of it before this moment, no. All he knew was far away. All he knew was Florida. What do you recommend?" asks my grandfather. "You have a favorite place down there?" This stranger takes a long, hard look at my grandfather. "When you get there, just keep driving south," he says. "Go far enough and you'll disappear." Summer, 1999, Boca Raton, Florida. I'm watching the Miss Florida pageant on television with my mother and Misty. In 1 week, I'll turn 11. We are judging the contestants, Misty and I, in our own point system of colored penciled tallies pressed into legal pads. We give each girl a score for every round of the pageant, but we also ask our own questions. Does the contestant seem smart? Does the contestant seem funny? Does the contestant seem like she would be nice to dogs? Would the contestant be our friend or enemy? Does the contestant look like either one of us? If given the choice, would we choose to swap lives with a contestant forever? "I wouldn't put your money against me," says my mother, "because today is July 11th. My mother's favorite number combination is 7-11. She has always played it on the roulette tables in Vegas, punched it in for alarm and banking passcodes, sworn by the magic of 7-11 on a clock. When these three numbers are arranged in this order, they become charged, lucky. Contestant number 2 is my favorite of the beauty queens. I have her name written at the top of my pageant chart. Marjorie, number 2, Hollywood. But Misty likes a blonde flute player from Miami Lakes. We bet our allowance money on the girls, usually $10. Here's why I'm invested. My cousin Tegan is a pageant girl. Chinese and Hawaiian, like me. She's 3 years older, and we look alike in the eyes, but Tegan's hair is long, her bangs trimmed ruler straight. Her adult teeth grew in perfectly, and her cheeks shine like bowding balls on the covers of magazines. In an ad for JCPenney, Tegan swings on a hammock with 3 other kids. She is the 13-year-old ethnic friend, licking chocolate cake from the prongs of a big fork, and this ad is enlarged on a poster board in the corner of her room. Whenever I sleep over, I fall asleep staring at her. "Contestant number 2 looks related to Tegan," I say. "She's got a good walk," says my mother. "Look at her go." My mother, too, was once a model, after high school. She tells us about it right now, in this living room, how she modeled clothing through the lobbies of Waikiki Beach hotels, tying and untying tropical wraps around her hips for Howley men. Now she catwalks in her pajamas across the living room, steady, open-lipped. She pushes her palms into her hips, each foot landing directly in front of the other. It looks a bit like hula, this grace, the exact point of her toes. Before she gets to the kitchen counter, strikes a pose looking left, then right, and marches her way back to the couch. Still got it? How could you be a model when you're a mom? Asks Misty. You're even better than contestant number two, I say. We watch the contestants on television strut through several more rounds. Go, Hapahauli, go, I scream. I wonder if my mother once looked like Marjorie, number two from Hollywood, if she once dreamed of being this very girl, her butter-colored bikini, her braid. Contestant number two does not win the crown. Instead, she hugs the two contestants by her side, mouthing, good luck, before smiling and waving her way off stage. Shocker, says my mother. Imagine that, a world that chooses white girls. I guess your number's off, I say. No, it's just that Miss USA could never be a mixy mutt, says Misty. She says this sweetly. She crosses out contestant number two on her chart. Misty's flute player does not win either. None of us take the cash. The world is so unfair, I say. More than you know, says my mother. 1973 through 1974, Plantation, Florida. My mother is wearing shoes to her first day of public school. Mary Jane's, to be exact, with high-ribbed socks, a pale green baby doll dress, and a lacy beige bib tucked over her chest. The mainland. This school is all indoors. There are no picnics outside, no bathing suits in sight. She is the Malihini in these halls, new blood, and everyone takes notice. The other students wear peanut bell-bottoms, three buttons at the crotch, their stomachs bare and oiled. Their hair shines the color of driftwood. For the first time in her life, nobody looks like my mother. A boy wads a spitball and pushes it into a straw. He shoots it at her. My mother spins in circles, rubbing her forehead, her dress fanning out. Fucking chink, says the boy, though my mother does not know what this means, and her parents do not tell her. They call me that too, I tell her now, growing up. My mother laughs. Of course they did. Almost 30 years and they can't think of something better. She meets him in her science class. Let's call him Samuel. My mother has always looked forward to science class, the gurgling chemicals, the slick cool of test tubes, her teacher, Mr. Jackson, who looks like the Michael Jackson if you squint hard enough. But now science is her absolute favorite subject since Samuel came around. He sits behind her and he stinks of Marlboros and pot. A howly boy with blonde hair and long waves. Sometimes she swears she can feel him breathing on her shoulders. Samuel wears rock t-shirts torn at the stomach, bare knees through the tears of his jeans. And his eyes, seriously, his eyes, she says, can turn a girl into a puddle. She tells Carla this, the only girl who will talk to her, her lab partner. Do you think he would ever? He's from the other side of the parking lot, she says. You're so bad. It's true, there are two sides of the school parking lot. On one side, Ned Cohen and the rest of the baseball team, the football team, their rows of matching jackets, plaids and collars, shining bowls of hair, arms hooked around calendar girls. They lean back on the hoods of their cars, flared khakis crossed at the knees, none of them ever talking very much. On the other side, the hippies, the afros, the braids, radio spun up, tongues on necks. This is where Samuel has been smoking his cigarettes before and after classes, where he stubs them out in meticulous piles, the place from which he has been watching my mother for months, the way her hair flicks over her shoulders, her whinny laugh, waiting for her. Carla scratches something into her notebook. Mr. Jackson is talking about the elegance of the periodic table when the paper is balled up, passed back and then forward, back and forward, until my mother receives it on her desk, smooths out the crinkles, squints at the smeared graphite shine of words. Would you ever go out with Loki? Yes or no? Samuel did not circle either word. Instead, he has written, sure. My mother presses her hands into the desk until there's a pale halo of steam. Have you heard about the shark movie with the lines wrapped around the plaza? Samuel asks my mother. I imagine it was he who'd suggested it. My mother is afraid of sharks. The two of them are sitting on a bridge walkway, legs dangling. It's impossible to get in. My sister and I can get into any movie, any time, says my mother. We know Ronald, the ticket guy. We're his favorites. The local movie theater exists inside a strip mall nearby, next door to a bookstore with carts of shriveled pages. My mother spends her summer days reading through them all, looking for the sexiest scenes. Recently, she opened up to a page describing a woman making love to a snake. She squeezed the book between her forearms, spreading the pages just enough to read the scene in that dark, electric inch. But really, it's the movie theater that matters most to my mother. How they take her away to that numbing realm outside herself, that other place that she will return to in different ways for the rest of her life. Sometimes Ronald the ticket man will let my mother stay inside for the entire day, where she'll watch and rewatch the same scenes, hum along to the same score, the same crescendos, mouthing each word of dialogue until the words sound like something she might say. My mother, Samuel, Tao, and her own boy decide to try the movie. It's Friday night, and it's true. The line for Jaws snakes around the parking lot. My mother and her sister pull their boys by the belt loops, past the crowds of smoke and denim, all the way to Ronald. Ronald's wearing his usual blue Adidas sneakers and sagging t-shirt. He pulls my mother and Tao in for a hug, my girls, and tilts his head to signal them in. In the theater, after Susan Baclini is yanked under that freckled gray sea, my mother leans into Samuel. She rests her head on his shoulder. She's tapping her foot on the movie theater floor. That's the way I see it now, anyway. She still does this. As the boy presses his thumb into her chin, gently turns her face, and kisses her. Here's Samuel, with a joint behind his ear, with peeled elbow scabs and Pink Floyd t-shirts and flunking grades. But the bad boy is not bad. To my mother, he's the soft stretch song of his stories, her kuipo, the way he is careful with her, a delicacy to his movements. When she stumbles, he corrects her, a hand on her back. You okay? It's the way he always pushes her hair behind her ear. I want to see you better. At home, after the movie, the boys ask to come inside. They want to spend the night with the girls. They'll be quiet, they promise. My mother decides against it. She says goodnight, another kiss against the wall of the house, their hips touching, a burst of warmth inside her. My Aunt Tao invites her boy in, where they will grind into their teenage love and fall asleep in her bed. When my grandfather finds them in the morning, crumpled sheets, their fingers clasped, he calls the police. My mother awakes to blue seesawing across her bedroom wall, the pounding of a hammer, her sister screaming, a thud. My grandfather has yanked Tao's door from the hinges, where it will never be replaced again, not as long as they all live under the same roof, though my grandfather will leave this place long before they do. Summer, 1997. The Harrington Inn, Geneva, Illinois. Here's how I learn about sex and babies. It's 1 a.m. and I feel like a loser. I competed in national pony finals today and placed 21st in the country. I am disappointed by this placing, but my mother reminds me that there are thousands of girls and boys who wake up at 4 in the morning and practice every day. Thousands of more expensive ponies, thousands of those kids and ponies in this very competition. I am still at the age in which plurality is terrifying. I hit every stride, I say. I didn't chip once. We had speed, my jacket with the tails. 21st out of thousands, she says. That's pretty impressive to me. I sit between her legs on the bed as she brushes my hair, both of us in bathrobes. She flips through the channels on the hotel television as I massage my calves, not paying attention. Everything hurts. "Look," says my mother. "Look, your favorite." It's JonBenet Ramsey on the news again. Here she is, smiling for a camera, my favorite pageant girl. My favorite dead girl. She waves. Flashbulbs sparkle in the space behind her head. "I love her," I say. "Why do you love her so much?" asks my mother. "It's very sad what happened to her. I found her pictures torn out under your bed. What is it?" "Because she was raped and murdered," I say. "That's a very sad thing to happen," says my mother. "That's the most horrible thing that could happen to a person." "What is rape?" I ask her. "And why is it horrible?" My mother places the hairbrush down on the bed. It's a deliberate movement for her, careful, slow. She turns me by the shoulder so that I am looking right at her, our faces close. "Rape is when someone forces sex on you," she says. "When you have sex without wanting to." "What is sex?" I ask. My cheeks are thumping. I think I might get in trouble for this question. It's a word that is always hushed in school, and my teachers get red and stuttery whenever it's mentioned. Instead, my mother rubs her thumb over my cheek and speaks softly. She sways me a little. She breaks down the anatomy and explains the parts we have. "These parts belong to us girls," she says, "but sometimes we can share." She tells me that sex can result in a child. She tells me it usually does. "But JonBenet's a child. She didn't have a child," I say. "That's why it's rape," she says, "and very wrong." "So sex is when you have sex with a child?" "It shouldn't be." "But this person used a rope on JonBenet and twisted the rope around her neck and had sex with her too at the same time. Is that how people have sex?" "No, that's why it's murder," she says. "And rape," I say. "And horrible and wrong," she says. "Do people usually die after sex?" "No. Does it feel like dying?" "Sometimes." "Can JonBenet's body still have a baby now that she's dead?" "No." "Can children have children?" "They shouldn't." "If I don't look like JonBenet, will anyone ever want to rape me?" "That's not the right question. Will I want to die?" Spring, 1976, Grassy Lake, Florida. Over spring break, the family drives to Grassy Lake. It's the little sister of Lake Placid, Florida, residential, gaping blue. On the lake shore, wooden cabins with screened-in porches slam their doors in a smashed metallic symphony as children run in and out to the water. My mother is here. She's stuck here with Tao, her brothers, and her parents. Her parents speak to each other less and less these days. Her father with his newspaper, his tiny sailboat, his heavy glasses of scotch, and her mother in the sun, oiled arms wrapped around her knees, watching dragonflies dipping O's in the water like smoke rings. My mother is just beginning to notice this disconnect, her two parents as people, two people who are very different indeed. Let's move to my mother in her room, in the full-length mirror, tying the frayed strings of a bikini top around her neck. She ties it so tight the knot digs. Her breasts are growing, they need more support, but she hasn't mentioned this to anyone. Right now, her body is still a secret. Today, she'll sail with her father on his two-person sailfish, but she feels different this year. His co-captain, the same bathing suit, awkward even. She pulls her bikini bottom up, up, trying to find a smoother spot near her waistline. Her body is changing, womanly, she thinks, but she does not know what to do with these new twists of muscle, these new hips. She walks out of her room, back into the patio, and takes a breath before opening the door. She feels the heat of the screen on her palm, pressing, walking out of it. My new body. The door slamming behind her in a crack. "How many times do I have to remind you about the damn door?" says her father, as he pulls ropes through the grass toward the boat. Both he and Mei Mei take a look at their daughter, their Hiapo girl, copper in the sun, like a woman. Her father squints. Her mother slides bulky square sunglasses down her nose. "Punahele, you've been eating all my sweets?" asks her father. "Look at that opu on those skinny bones."
"I'm just changing," says my mother. She folds her arms over her stomach.
"No more poi for you, I guess," says my grandma, winking. She knows how much my mother hates poi, the gray sludge of Hawaiian not quite dessert.
"You look fine," she says.
"Kuli kuli," says my mother, in three hard blinks. She marches back into the patio, pushing the door for an extra slam. That evening, in the shower, my mother decides to move someplace up north after graduation. She wants a place with a pale, chalky sky and winters that hurt. A place where she can wear giant knit sweaters every day, the fabric loose and her body unrecognizable. Every last sweep of her skin protected.
Spring 2016. Peterborough, New Hampshire. Manchester, Vermont. Voorheesville, New York. My mother flies to New Hampshire to pick me up. Her hair is burned around the ears, curled where it has never been curly. She has a new cough from staying in the house too long. She refused to leave without our dogs. We drive through Vermont and stay the night. On the hotel television, the news reports that new evidence has emerged against O.J. Simpson. They found a knife on the premises. Another channel tells us about a new JonBenet docuseries.
"Here we go again," says my mother.
"You ever feel like history just keeps repeating itself, never stops circling?" The next morning, we drive to Hannah's house. I am happy to see her home, which is not burned, but upright, sturdy, warm. I am happy to lie in her bed. I am happy to smell her hair, her sweaters. Mostly, I'm happy to see Hannah, who's been writing me letters, checking in. In the corner of the room, she's organized my things. Socks, pillows, stacks of books, the Christmas gifts. It's all still here.
"Let's do those DNA tests," I tell Hannah.
Her mother bought her one, too.
"Do what?"
asks my mother.
"This spit test," I say.
"You send it in the mail, and this company supposedly breaks down your ancestry," I say. "That family tree I've been planning on."
"Why would you want to do all that?"
My mother closes the book on her lap. Hannah and I open the kits. We spit into the plastic tubes. I make puckering faces as I try to produce enough saliva to fill to the line, not too many bubbles. We watch the liquid settle. I punch in a blue gel to activate the test, shake the tube. I place it back in the pre-stamped box and hand it over. Later that night, in bed, Hannah asks me about the past few months, New Hampshire, the dreams about my father, my drinking, my health. "You ever sit in the car or in a window seat on the subway and the car or train next to you starts to move and you think you're the one moving? And you'd swear by it, and sometimes in your stomach you can even feel it?"
"That," I say, "that's what life's like now."
Spring, 1976, Hollywood, Florida. The call comes in the middle of the night, though Peter Gelbwax is still at work. He's been working all hours lately, selling insurance to pay off the medical bills for the daughter who never came home. Osteogenesis imperfecta. Her name, he and his wife told the attorney, was supposed to be Dana. Hear the phone ringing. See Sharon Gelbwax, 26 years old, asleep in her bed, alone.
"Hello?" she picks up. "Peter?"
It's the attorney. "I have a question for you," the attorney says, "and answer honestly." Sharon is just beginning to make out the voice, its familiarity, the person on the other end of the line, when the attorney says, "If I were to tell you I found a baby, but it's biracial, would you still be interested?"
"Yes," she says.
"Of course I would. Of course we would."
"Do you want to ask your husband?"
Sharon pauses.
"Could they?" Could they really provide a life for this baby? Jewish parents, a Jewish sister, in which this child would feel comfortable, understood? Would the child be taunted? Would she know how to cut the child's hair? She thinks back to their last meeting with the attorney, 150 applications slapped down on the desk ahead of them. "This girl is young," said the attorney. "No prenatal care. She found out too late to do anything about it. By the look of her, I can tell how she got herself into trouble." "Our daughter Dana had a place in our house, a bassinet," said Sharon. "I spent my whole pregnancy making this bassinet every day I did, and then I guess I never really had to make it." "We're good people," Peter had said. "Every bone in our daughter's body was broken." Sharon grips the phone harder. "Peter says, of course," she lies. "Well, that's good news," says the attorney, "because no other applicant was interested. If you meet me at my office tomorrow, we'll get to signing some papers." "Congratulations," he says, "and good night." In ancient Hawaiian folklore, the worst fate to befall someone is for their spirit, or uhane, to be abandoned. Spirits should be visited, cared for, returned to, nurtured. Any spirit should be treated as one's family. Hawaiians are told to check for the presence of uhane by peering into bowls of water or lacing a trail of leaves on the ground. A human will tear the leaves with their own weight or show up reflected in the water. A spirit will not. Forgotten spirits are called kueva. They are left to chew on mothballs, to haunt forever the empty dark. Sometimes, if truly angered, these forgotten spirits will visit the places they once knew and relive their histories. Huakaipo. This is the term I was taught. Marchers of the night. Summer, 1997. Seven Devils, North Carolina. I've been sworn out of the house. We're in Seven Devils, North Carolina, and my mother says, "Go now. Drive down the mountain. Go fishing, go." She is baking a cake for my 9th birthday party. I know this much. But she and my father are also planning a surprise for me, a mini horse named Tulip. My aunts and uncles drive me down the mountain to the trout farm. My hair is still cut short, and I'm wearing my new denim overalls with a floppy silk sunflower on the pocket. I pierce the kernels of corn, bob clumsily with my rod, while my cousins play with the worms, pretend to eat them. My mother has always cast a line for me, and I'm unsure how to do it alone. I jiggle the release back and forth, jerk the pole up and down like I'm trying to rouse a rabbit from a hat. I fling the pole above my head, spin it in circles, swipe it like a baseball bat toward the lake, the hook flying in a tiny spark. I don't feel the snag. I don't see it. But I hear the swarm of bees descend around my body. Wings zoom, breaking the air. My vision splits. My face vibrates all over. I swat my arms, screaming, hoping the bees don't fly into my mouth. I kick, swing, fall, cry. It seems to last forever, this buzzing, though it couldn't have been very long at all. There are arms, my aunt's, lifting me. The hump of her steps as she's running, running, bringing me to the trout hut. "She might need an ambulance," I hear her say. Everything is burning. I don't understand what has happened. "Are you allergic to bees?" she asks me, but she is already speaking to someone else. "This girl, she's allergic to everything." My aunt is hysterical. I am playing dead. Moving hurts. My eyes don't want to open. And then, this moment, a memory that doesn't change, that needs no revision, no matter how many times I summon it. The sound of gravel rumbling under tires, the speed of Big Bow. My mother running to me, yanking me from my aunt's soft arms. "What happened?" she says. "I knew something was wrong." When I open my eyes, my mother's face is there. She's kissing my cheek, saying, "I came as fast as I could." According to my grandma Rose, my mother was frosting the cake when it happened. She was smoothing the chocolate with a spoon when she felt it. That thing dropped silver to the floor. Something's wrong, she said. I have to go. She started driving before the car door was even shut. No seatbelt, no shoes. That mother-daughter power, she'd say for years. It's bigger than logic. The bees stung my face, my eyelids, my hands, even my scalp. In the car, I stared at my thumb swelling like dough, and I said my goodbyes. I will die at my own birthday party. How unfair. What I knew about bees sprung from Macaulay Culkin's body in a casket. Turns out, I was not allergic to them. But that mother-daughter thing? I believe in it now. It's something that can spool out forever like a string between two cups. A thread that will hum when you need it. Summer, 1976. Plantation, Florida. The attorney wants my mother to sign the papers. She's back home now, an empty bedroom. There's no evidence of what the past 9 months had meant. No baby clothes, no bassinet, no embroidered name, no pictures. I won't sign them, she says. I didn't even want to do this. But you did do this, says the attorney. We had a deal. My grandfather and grandmother look at my mother. They motion for her to go on, pick up the pen. They have already received the checks, signed their own papers. Not unless you tell me what I had, says my mother. A boy or a girl? I can't tell you, child, says the attorney, but I still need you to sign. 15 minutes later, my mother walks the attorney back out to his car. She is barefoot. Her face is swollen, pale. I imagine she uses the same voice she uses now when she wants something. Please, she says. The mosquitoes are out. I can't tell you that, says the attorney. Legally, I can't. Please, says my mother. She holds her stomach. Flat. According to the hospital paperwork I read now, my mother is 16 years old and 98 pounds. The attorney opens his car door. He bends to get in, but pauses. He looks back at my mother. When your child gets married one day, he says, they will probably change their name. 1976, Hollywood, Florida. My baby, she's mine. Sharon Gelbwax must get used to saying it aloud to anyone who will ask, repeating it until it goes true. She's heard the horror stories, birth mothers changing their minds. Sometimes in the hospital, sure, but also sometimes later. She's heard about mothers refusing to sign the papers, refusing to let go. She's heard of mothers getting clean, realizing what they had done in that black haze of greed, coming back, mine. Mothers were always coming back. What mother wouldn't? As Sharon looks at the newborn in her room, sleeping, she can't imagine it. Not coming back for her. Perfect, this baby. Her baby. The way her head feels like velvet. The way her skin smells like paper. Oh, the noises. A real human girl. My baby. It doesn't matter where she came from, what the birth mother ate during her pregnancy, what she looked like. No, the baby is Sharon's, whomever she and Peter would mold her to be, and they would protect this child for the rest of her life. This baby would grow up different, not looking like anyone else. The hair, she thinks. Look at this hair. But Sharon feels prepared for these lessons. She feels prepared to learn. One day, in JCPenney, Sharon pushes the baby, her baby, around in a stroller. She is looking for towels and home goods when she sees the woman. This woman is too old to be the mother, not a teenager, she's sure. Could it be the grandmother? An aunt? The Asian woman pauses, looks into her stroller. An Asian baby, she says. So cute, this baby. The Asian woman has two sons with her. They have dark skin, island boys. The boys tug on the leg of her jeans. These could be the brothers, Sharon thinks. They must be. Thank you, says Sharon. She's mine. Doesn't look like you,
She's mine. How old's the baby?
Couple of months, says Sharon, before pushing the stroller through the aisle, hooking a right, and exiting the mall. 1976, Hollywood, Florida. She sees them everywhere, Asian babies, Hapa babies, in her dreams, in the grocery store, at the mall. All babies look the same to my mother, like old white men, indistinguishable, really. But this baby, her baby, would look different. Her baby would look like an island girl, she was sure, a warm tone to her skin, tiny eyes, the hair. Would her baby recognize its own mother? She's taking pills to keep her breasts from lactating, but would they drip at the sound of her baby's cry? There must be something, she thinks, between mother and child, a magnetic jolt between the two that cannot be eased apart. But how long would it take to find her? Where would she be? In which town? How would it ever happen? What is my daughter's name? She wonders. She thinks about this all the time. The babies are everywhere. At least, she thinks she sees them. The crescent cheek in a stroller, the black silky swirl at the top of a head. Her body will recover the connection, she thinks, the recognition of her baby, some residuum of those blurry hours in the hospital. The eyes may forget, but the body, it remembers. When my mother graduates high school, she takes a job as a hostess at a posh Japanese restaurant. The managers dress her in a kimono. They don't care that she's not Japanese. She looks close enough. She scans the room each night, wondering if the new parents of her daughter might take her here. An Asian experience, she imagines them saying, but she never does find them. Instead, she watches as the hibachi chefs learn to throw knives, and she is there to bandage their fingers after each miss. She returns home to shower off the stink of burned onions. She falls asleep curled in a towel each night, her hair still wet. On the weekends, she takes a job as a floor bunny at the downtown Playboy Club. She is weighed in each evening, an extra pound allowed during her period, by a mother bunny who has taught her to bunny perch when serving men their drinks. Breasts forward, in their face, left knee tucked behind right. Remember, they own you. Remember to be pretty. You must move forward, her sister Tao says. You've got a whole story after this. But their mother and father have separated. My mother's baby is gone. Her life feels pow, over before it ever started. My mother moves back to Honolulu for 1 year. She moves into Tutu's sewing room, where flying roaches buzz against the walls. Although this is her island, it has changed since she was a girl. She feels malihini, new again, like a tourist, and her tutu tries to bring back her old music, the accent on her tongue, the slow-cooked meats and body language. During the day, my mother takes a bus to the Ala Moana shopping center, where she will try on whatever clothes she is given, climb up into a window, and pose. She is told to suck in, stretch her neck into a C, stand up straight, smile. She is good at this. I can imagine her as if I were there. I imagine her poised, eyes following each person walking by, legs buckled at the knees. I imagine my mother waiting for somebody, anybody, to stop. Fall, 2015. New York, New York. Atlantic Beach, New York. If I have the flu, I can't be around you, I say into the phone. Get one of those nerd masks, says my father. The ones you Asians wear on the planes? Tell Mom thanks for passing this on. I was up all night sweating off a fever. Mom's making me chicken soup today, he says. I also feel lousy. Good, it's her turn. You took care of me last week. That bean stew helped. It's my turn. I can't get out of bed, I say. And I really can't come this weekend with your immune system how it is. Have a driver get you out here, I'll pay. I just want to sleep. I need to be home. You sound terrible, really. I sound like you. You sound like me. Well, I guess we're both stuck, I say. At least we've got the phone. I guess that's safe. Drink water, Daddy. Take care of yourself, baby. I love you. Feel better. Okay now. You too. Later that night, when I arrive alone to my parents' dark house, the pot of water on the stove has gone cold, the chicken thighs still pink in their styrofoam casing. The vegetables are peeled, lined up in a row, a knife dropped with a carrot still clinging to the blade of it. 1980, Miami, Florida. My mother responds to an ad and takes a job as a secretary. She wears an outfit that says she knows what she's doing, that she is more than an island girl or a Playboy bunny or a window and hotel model. No, she is serious here. 20 years old, a woman, with her hair pinned back, a pencil skirt hugging her knees. She will be sophisticated, yes. She is going to make something of her life. On her first day, a man walks through the door, combing his hair. He wears sunglasses, his jacket swung over his shoulder, hooked on a finger. His cologne, a velvet spice she'll go chasing for the rest of her life. He passes right by her at first, pauses, then walks backward to her desk. "I don't believe we've met," he says. "You must be my new girl." "Your secretary, yes," says my mother. The man reaches for her hand and bows to her. He kisses her between the pointer and middle knuckles, peering up above his glasses. My mother crosses and uncrosses her legs beneath her desk. She does not know how to use her body in this moment with this man. He is older, bejeweled, his hands so certain. "I'm John Madden," he says. "See my parents the moment they meet." Spring 2016, New York, New York. She calls me first. It's 1:59 p.m. on a Thursday, and I'm at my desk when the phone rings. "Hello, my name is Marjorie," she says. "From the DNA site?" It is my mother's voice exactly, but it is not my mother on the phone. The name, Marjorie, is not my mother's name. "Hello," I say to the voice of my mother. "I'm at work. Let me step out for a moment." I exit the building and stand on the sidewalk of 26th Street, next to a Holiday Inn. It's an overcast day, still a chill in the air. Men with briefcases walk in a cluster and bump around my body to get by. "Thanks for getting back to me," I say. "Like I said, I've been working on this family tree." "Oh, of course," she says. "I hope I can help." "So, who are you? A secret cousin of mine? Or an aunt? I know it says 1,706 centimorgans on the site, but I'm not sure what that means. And your picture, it's so small. I can only see your hair, really. So, who are your parents?" "Why did you take the test?" she wants to know. This woman. "My father died 6 months ago," I say. "The tree... I'm just trying to fill in the blanks, I guess. There's a lot in my family, just a lot." "I see. I'm so sorry to hear that." "The test was a gift, a Christmas gift." "Okay," she says. We are both breathing heavily into the phone. I'm not sure why that is. "Why did you take it?" I ask. "Well," she says, "I was adopted at birth." I watch a slouching man push a hot dog cart around the corner. I watch a woman exit the ceramic shop with a brown paper bag strangling her wrist. I scuff the sidewalk with the toe of my loafer. I'm not sure what to say to this woman. "Maybe we could both help each other." "I think we can, yes," she says. "Well, I think you may be my cousin, or aunt," I say. "I'm pretty sure. My family... there's a lot no one talks about." I do not want to be the one to tell her this. She must be my grandfather's. He had women on the side. I do not want to tell her that he never mentioned another child. He never went to look. I don't have a clue who the mother might be. Mostly, I do not want to tell her that my grandfather has been dead for almost 20 years. "I've seen a picture of you," she says. on the internet. I feel like I'm looking into a mirror. Everyone in my family looks alike, I say. Island genes, they're strong. But it's like looking directly into a mirror, she says. Do you understand what I'm saying? I think you may be my aunt, I say. Please, help me, she says. I've been looking all my life. Please. The hot dog man is gone. A girl smokes outside the Holiday Inn. She's on a bench talking on the phone. She sips soda out of a green bottle. On her knee, half a sandwich in plastic wrap. I'll try to help you, I say. Tell me what you know. I know that for every birthday of my entire life, I've woken up wondering if my mother remembers the day, if she's thinking of me, if she looks like me, if she knows. Let's start from the beginning, I say. Where were you born? Hollywood, Florida, she says. That's somewhere between Miami and Boca Raton. I know it, I say. I was born around there, too. When? July 11th, 1976, she says. 7-11. It's one of the few things I know. My sister and I speak to each other every morning and every night. We check in all day. I can't focus on anything but her. The pictures of her face, the way her voice sounds like my mother, the words that she uses to describe the moon, the descriptions of her house, her favorite movies. She leaves me voicemail singing Joni Mitchell songs. We both love Joni. We have the same favorites. And I play them and replay them. My sister. My sister can sing. My sister. We send each other photos all day long, and I zoom in to see her face more clearly. I want to see every beauty mark, every angle of her teeth. At night, we go through the lists. What is your favorite meal? What is your favorite memory? Do you like mustard? Can you drink or do you get Asia glow? Who was your first kiss? What's your husband like? What's your girlfriend like? Did you always know you were gay? What are my nieces like? What was your childhood like? What is our mother like? My mom is kind, I say. She always smells good. She writes a beautiful letter. You're going to love her. I constantly correct myself. Our mom. Ours. It is like preparation for death, I think. Describing my mother, her entire life. Who she's been as a person, who she is now. I am used to talking about my father this way. You would have loved him, but never my mother. We fall asleep, one of us still talking, the other mumbling into the phone. Are you still there? One of us will say. Yes, keep going, please, talk. The relationship we have is nothing short of obsessive. Hannah is worried. She does not want me to have my heart broken. Careful, she says. She can already tell I am in love. I just wonder, I say, what do you think she looks like naked? Do you think we have the same hips? The same legs? Are our breasts the same size and shape? Do you think hers are fake? Will I look like her in 12 years? Why don't you meet each other first? How long should I wait before I tell her I love her? Meet each other, she says. My sister has had a flight booked for months, to New York, the following week. She owes her best friend a visit, she says. My mother has had a flight booked to New York the same week. She owes me a visit, she says. I can't tell Mom on the phone, I tell my sister. I'll sit down with her, explain. We'll go from there. I'm sure she'll want to meet you too. My sister says, thank you, I'd like that. But I can tell she does not have her hopes up. Winter, 1988, Coconut Grove, Florida. My mother has skipped her period once, twice, three times by now. She was told after the first child that she had an ovarian obstruction, twists and bumps inside her, little chance to ever be pregnant again. I thought there was no chance, she tells my father now. She is sitting on the floor of her living room. She is trying to tell him something.
What are you trying to tell me? You said it was impossible, he says.
He is pacing the room. He pumps his fist inches from the wall of her canary yellow apartment as if he will let it go, as if he will smash this entire wall down and expose the stars, but he does not.
Get rid of it, he says.
I will not get rid of it, says my mother. I won't. I'll have nothing to do with it, he says. I have a family. God damn it, you know I have a family. I don't have the money.
I'm keeping this baby, says my mother.
Maybe you should have considered your family sometime in the past 8 years, but I haven't heard much about them till now.
She wants to tell him. She wants nothing more than to tell this man, my father, that her stomach has been stretched this way before. Her stomach had been stretched over a living, breathing heart. Her body molded to it. She was sent away to live in an apartment complex with her 14-year-old sister. She pumped this baby with her own blood, fed and nurtured it. Her stomach stretched, and then it was emptied, and ever since there has been a cave behind her ribs where her daughter once lived. She wants to tell him everything, to finally tell someone this secret, the way her father smashed a vase when she told him, the way he drove her to one group home, then the next, before settling her into that apartment where her baby would be born, then taken. She wants to be held like a child again, but instead my father is pacing. He is shaking his fist, and he is saying, God damn it, God damn you, woman. You did this to hurt me, God damn this. You must get rid of it, will you? Don't be such a goddamn woman. Look at me when I'm talking to you. I have a goddamn family. I have a wife, 2 children. I don't need a bastard child.
Then leave, says my mother. Don't see me anymore.
What?
I'm keeping this child. I need this one thing.
You can leave, she says.
She wanted to tell him. 35 years together. She never did. My mother moves back in with her sister while she is pregnant with me. The two of them watch horror movies, eat stacks of saltine crackers. It's the only thing my mother can stomach. They match up the grooves of puzzles on the living room floor. They tend to Tanya and Tegan. My Aunt Tal rubs lotion on my mother's feet, and they are girls again, young again, catching up, doing this very thing all over again. My mother is reading The Great Gatsby. Sometimes she recites passages aloud. F. Scott Fitzgerald, says my mother. I like the sound of that. The letter in front. Powerful, yeah?
You're right, says my aunt. Those with the initial names.
I want a powerful child, says my mother. My child won't be a coward. And I'm going to put a letter in front. No other name, no abbreviation, just the letter.
You're crazy, says my aunt. You can't just put a letter in front.
Maybe T, says my mother. You're the one taking care of me, aren't you? You and these girls. My baby may be fatherless, but she'll always have women. Yes, I'm going to call her T. Al Al-Makua is a place in the afterworld in which all of one's ancestors are waiting. I always like this legend best, the idea of this place, where all family ties remain solid, intact, where nothing on earth ever mattered. It is the place in which all family members are reunited, and I like to imagine that everyone shows up young, healthy, so much bright life in the face. In all the realms of heaven and hell, Au Aumakua is the most desired among the people of Hawaii. Once the family is reunited, each spirit is encouraged to visit their own idea of home. Home can be in the depths of the sea, in the treetops. A spirit may choose their grandmother's lap in her rocking chair, the sour smell of malasadas. Ancient legend describes it as the place of your greatest responsibility. Others define it as returning to one's rightful place or one's greatest duty. The Hawaiian word for this is kuleana. Spring, 2016. New York, New York. My mother opens her bedroom door, walks out, chugs water in the kitchen, walks back in, shuts the door, opens the door, shuts the door, walks into the bathroom, shuts the door, opens the door, walks back to the kitchen, drinks more water, joins me in the living room, sits on the couch, opens and shuts her eyes, opens and shuts them, says things like, "Who?" And "What will I tell your father?" "He doesn't know," she says. She is shaking. "There's so much. He's dead," I say. "You don't have to worry about that." She's not here, my mother. She's somewhere else, I can tell, replaying something, reckoning with something. She's in another time. "Don't worry about Dad," I say, "and don't worry about me." In the next 5 minutes, my mother scrambles on in incomplete sentences. "Where is she? The girl? Does she hate me? Do you hate? How can you even look at me? What does she look like? Her name? Where is she? Who found whom? My daughter, does she hate me? It wasn't me who let her go. I was scared. You have to understand. What happened was this, but where is she?" I break down the facts. I repeat them several times until she is steady, until she can hold them. Her name, where she lives, what she does. "Here, look," I say, offering a photograph. "She's had a good life," I say. "I see," she says. "The girl is beautiful," she says. "Your daughter, she's beautiful," I agree. "She looks like you, and like me. Perhaps one day, maybe we could meet her," says my mother. "Maybe for the holidays?" The next day, we decide to meet in Washington Square Park. It's 2:30 p.m., New York University's graduation day, so the entire park is bobbing with purple and silver balloons. Families grasp one another by the elbows. "I'm so proud of you," the sun throwing stripes of light between them. I am holding my mother's hand. A banjo player cries out and knocks his kick drum. We wait beneath the arc, circling, looking, my hand a visor over my eyes as my focus shifts from face to face. "Will I know?" "How will we know?" asks my mother. "There are so many people." A child steps inside a wet circle of rope. A man lifts the rope with a stick until the child is swallowed by a giant bubble. The girl looks calm like this, inside the wobbling rainbow. I wish I could crawl inside it too. I'd take an extra layer of anything between me and the world right now. Anything to soften the noise. The crowd thickens. The clapping, the drumming, the screaming, the stroller wheels, the voices all coalesce into a dented mirage of sound. And then I see her, and my mother sees her, and she sees us. And we see her. It's impossible to say which comes first. It's impossible to say much more than, "We saw her." Hair that looks blue in the sun. The shape of her. My face in her face. My mother's walk in her walk. The length of her arms. Her chin. The round cheeks. We all know it without knowing. She is mine. Ours. The bubble splats in the air. A wad of liquid bursting. Behind my sister, a blonde is taking a video on a camcorder. She is the flute player, contestant number 4 from Miami Lakes, my sister's best friend. We all reach each other. "Hi," is all we say. "My sister." All of our arms reach out. We dampen each other's shoulders. We don't say much more, just, "Hi, hi." The three of us together like that. Our hair all blending, our height exactly the same, the way it all somehow fits. Under a tree on the north side of the park, we sit and slide our shoes off, comparing our feet in the grass. The same unfortunate toenails, the ankles. The three of us cannot stop looking and commenting at one another's faces. The slope of the nose, the ways in which our mouths move when we speak. Mother, sister, daughter, mother. She was there all along. How did we miss her? How many times had we opened a door for one another in our lives? How many county fair Ferris wheels? Days rotating our towels on the same beach. Contestant number 4, the flute player from Miami Lakes, takes a photograph of us on my camera. "This will be the first photo I have where I look like the other people in it," says my sister. We walk the streets of Soho and Chinatown for the rest of the day, holding hands. We stop on each corner and look up at the buildings. I explain our geography, the terracotta, this other home of mine, the one I've made for myself. I walk hunched beneath the umbra of these buildings every day, but today they are magnificent. That night, over dinner at a quiet restaurant, my mother begins telling my sister about Samuel. "A good boy," she says. "There was so much love there. I want you to know that you came from love." My sister nods, listening carefully, and I think this is what she must have looked like as a child. This very expression. This is what I missed. "It's funny," says my mother. "I haven't seen him in so long, but I can see him now, in you. You have his eyebrows. It's like I can see him again." My sister begins to cry. My mother moves from next to me to my sister's side of the table. She wraps her arms around my sister's body. "Baby girl, it's okay," she says, rocking her. "My baby girl." Kissing her on the top of the head, exactly like she would to me, like my mother had never missed any time like this, not a moment without her firstborn girl, her hiapo. January 2018, Oahu, Hawaii. "I'm thinking of calling the piece Kuleana," I tell my cousin Sarah. We're drinking beers outside Ala Moana. I've been here 2 weeks retracing my mother's story. Her school, the banyan trees, the shopping mall windows, those rocks behind her childhood home. I held each rock in my hand, as if the light tug of their weight could somehow collapse time. Tell me more. Tomorrow, I'll go back home. "That sounds about right," she says. "What's your interpretation of the term?" I ask. Sarah was born and raised here, in Kalihi. She has a deeper understanding of the language than I do. "When I was little, I used to think it meant chores," she says. "But it's much bigger than that. It's a person's greatest duty, or responsibility, or privilege." "Right," I say. "I think it applies with my mother's return to her past, her kids, the bigness of that." "That's not what I was thinking," she shakes her head. "What were you thinking?" "It's your mother's kuleana to be with her children, yes, that's true," she says. "But that's not why the title works. That's not the point of this story." "What's the point?" "Your kuleana," she says. "It is your kuleana to tell it." This is a secret of my own. My father has been helping me write these pages. In my dreams, my father stands in our house. It is not burned or blackened or infelicitous. No melted pools of television screens, not yet. My rocking horse is still there, rocking. The air is clear. The dining room table shines. It's all in one piece, this house, the way I've always imagined it could be. So is my father. Sometimes he says the things I wrote the way I wrote them. We play out the scenes. We have our script. Other times, he says, "No, not quite. It didn't happen like that." My dead father is always moving. I follow him. "I wasn't standing in the living room for that part," he says. "The night of your middle school dance, I was standing right here, by the hall." He brings me to the mouth of the hallway. The light is on. He walks me back and forth through it, buttoning his shirt, tucking it in, rushing, getting ready for something. He disappears into the wall and reappears on the living room couch. "You must get it right," he says. "Remember the details," he says. He smooths a comb through his hair. It's still wet from a shower. I sit down next to my dead father. "No one prepares you for the dreams." I want to breathe in the shoulder of his shirt. "I want to breathe in the shoulder of your shirt," I say. "But I can't remember it right." "It's all gone now," I say, the house, the details. He lights a cigarette. My father is never sick in my dreams. He is not plugged into tubes. He has no oxygen mask. Here, we are both breathing. What's missing is always there, he says. He taps the center of my forehead 3 times. Relax, he says. There are so many ways to lose a person. There are so many revisions. But wait, there's something else, Hannah says. We're sitting in her truck in her driveway upstate. It is midnight, just after my 29th birthday, and the engine is turned off, the air soured with hay. It's not what you think, she says. She rubs the back of her neck. Hannah, who'd spent the past month with my family, housing 2 of my teenage cousins while I'd traveled through July. Hannah, who'd overheard something she should not have heard while I was gone, who'd jerked across a freeway to the side of the road when she'd heard it, she'd stopped and she'd listened again. Hannah, who'd wanted to wait until after I came home to tell me herself, my hands in hers, she'd wanted to wait until after my birthday. I'm glad she found her sister, is what she'd heard. But where is the brother? What are you talking about? I say. I'm still trying to figure it out, she tells me. That night, in her driveway, I punch the truck's window until I feel bone. Let me try this again. My family, we began with a mannequin. He was a full-body jewelry mannequin. Fancy, distinguished. Those were the words we used. When I was 2 years old, my mother and I lived alone in a canary yellow apartment in Coconut Grove, Florida. See my mother, single, the crimson mouth mistress of my father, a white man in downtown Miami, who's been promising to leave his artist wife, his 2 handsome boys. We needed a man in our home, a figure bigger than us to scare off all the other men who would come. This is the story I know. But let me go truer. Before my father arrives at our apartment, my mother sits the mannequin in a rocking chair near the front window. My mother and I like to change his socks together. We pull the bright patterns over his club feet, roll the bands up his calves. We'll do this again years from now, for my father, just before he dies. Merritt's cigarettes, orange juice and vodka, money. I miss the grind of his voice. I miss the word when it was still golden. Father. This here is your father. Hello, little one, I'm your father. My mother, a Chinese-Hawaiian pocket knife of a woman, shot a man once. She's already lost her own father, her islands, Samuel, a daughter. The gift of naming that daughter and holding her and tossing her into the air. The joy in that suspension. But then, there was another. There is always the point at which a story changes. A good story must always change its terms. I'm glad she found her sister, but where is the brother? Another missed period. Another month of nausea. Another month. Another talk on the living room floor between my mother and father as I squirmed in a crib. You can't keep him, my father says. We've done this before. I can. We can't. That's how I imagine the scene going. That's what I've been told. My mother kept carrying that baby. She thought my father would change his mind. The mannequin, he'd had a greater purpose. He protected me, and he protected my mother as she grew, as she listened for noises at the window. I don't remember pressing my ear to her stomach saying, "Hello," but I did that. Sometimes we choose what to believe. Sometimes we know it. Like this. Uncle Nuke was left on our curb one Christmas wearing a Santa hat. I was 6. My mother went back out for him, the trash bag still waiting for pickup, but he was gone already. Off to another family, or little girl, who needed him. The truth is, I hadn't missed him till now. I never even knew he was gone. I thought your father would change his mind once the boy was born, says my mother. I'd waited for that. These hushed years, these secrets of the body, to whom did they belong first? I want to find where it began and say, I'm here now, listening. I want to reach through the years and tell the women I've been lonely. My father stopped breathing on a cold, clear afternoon. October. The sun was out. My mother was making him soup. The story I'd rather tell? I make it out to the beach that day. My half-brothers are there, and my half-sister. My baby brother, too. We are all familiar to one another. We're a family. Truer. My brother was born on January 27, 1990, in Miami, Florida. Before he was adopted, my parents named him. I was sent to Disney World when he was born, though I will never remember that. Baby boy. Beautiful, I know it. I never got to meet him. You could have told me, I say now to my mother, all of this. My father, he married her. I wore a yellow dress. They kept me. Son, my father used to say. There once was a girl on a flying horse, and everybody loved her. That's the unfinished story. That's all.